Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
You know, somehow it's every week is just so centering to hear the voice of Brian Brown, the founder of the Brown Briefly, talk about less is more, more or less, and inviting everybody to make us part of your day. So I certainly welcome those who are listening in to see how our days are going, and hopefully your day is going well as well. Hey, so we have five brieflies, and I just want to do a quick check-in. I'm Kevin. I'm hosting the show this week. We have Lynn and Truman and Gail and Bruce. And briefly have Bruce's, I think, a grandchild joining us on yes. Zoom here. But, anyway, how's it going for folks? Bruce, how are you doing?
Well, we're doing great. It's very interesting. This time of year, you begin to get the king tides. And so KVIB disappears twice a day, once in the dark, so you can't really see it. But right now, you know, just about this time, it's just the tides just beginning to turn. But it's always interesting to see that beach and at low tide in the summer, you know, the whole point is out and the sand spit. And now you look at it in the middle of the winter, the wind's blowing, it's kind of cold and drizzly. And all except the logs are underwater. And so it's a very interesting sort of cyclical process to watch every day, particularly this time of year, as the beach disappears and reappears. And in the future, I suspect will disappear even more.
Well, you, and your fellow Ellis Fortian thought she had her hand up to make a comment as well.
I just wanted to say good morning and that I've been kind of busy with a couple of things in my family, but also in getting ready for the child vaccine programs, which the MRC is the Medical Reserve Corps here on Vachon, part of Public Health Reserve Volunteers, are cooperating with the schools to host several clinics starting tomorrow and Thursday for the younger grades for kids in schools to start getting their vaccines. So I urge the parents to think about how to prepare your kids about, you know, kind of bringing a favorite stuffed animal, kind of being curious about how the process works to protect them and their families and to act things out so they're prepared. We'll have lots of staff on hand to help make sure people are coming in masks and understand the process and are being observed by people who are well-trained to do so. And so we're hopeful to get the rest of Vachon vaccinated shortly.
Fantastic. Yeah. Gail, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Kevin. Nice to see everyone this morning. Yes, I was just going to weigh in on the king tides. They, I'm experiencing them on the west side of the island as well, of course. And they really are something to contend with these days because if you have the combination, especially of stormy weather like we get at this time of year, typical November out there, windy and wet, and with a king tide, you can think, for us who live in a walk-in, our only access is via down a boardwalk. So it can be challenging to duck and weave between the rollers. So yeah, I keep thinking we ought to find a way to harness the tide's energy. You know, it is such an amazing force. When I think, like Bruce was saying, you know, the amount of water that moves in and out twice a day, most people understand that is how the tides work, two highs a day, two lows a day, the sheer volume of water that moves in and out in and around the Salish Sea is so tremendous. And around the world, of course, this happens. So that's one of the technologies I'd love to learn more about.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was someplace in Canada, up north of Nanaimo, when you get into the rapids, there was an installation. They were trying to harvest some of that tidal flow And if you've never seen the Boer Tide in Alaska, Anchorage, I believe it is, when the tides are really high and running back and forth through Turnagain, I think.
It's a Turnagain arm.
Is the one, Turnagain arm, where Cook, I think, was said, here we go, we have to turn around again to find the Northwest Passage. People can actually surf the waves of the incoming tide. The waves are so high. So there is energy for sure.
Yeah.
But well, and here Truman, I just want to say 99.53%. 99.53%.
99.53%.
The latest from the Secretary of State.
Oh, that was that my win.
County Airport District Commissioner position. The 99, that write-in threat 0.47, McDuff or whatever, just didn't.
Snoopy.
I didn't see who the write-ins were. Is there a way to look at that or?
Not that I
probably not.
Probably not. Yeah. Well, I thought. Well, one of the last one I saw, there were like 15 write-ins. I don't know what the final count was.
No, actually, when they certify the election, they will actually publish the results, and they'll publish the list of every write-in candidate.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah, I'd like to see.
Fantastic.
To find out if Bodie McBoatface was your primary component.
Yeah, probably. Hey, I was going to mention about the tides. Years ago, speaking of Alaska, years ago when I used to haul fish off the beach up in Alaska, of course we had tide tables. That's what determined when we could go on and off the beach. And the beach up there was very shallow. So boy, when the tides came in, it came in with a vengeance. I mean, it really came in fast. And boy, we had to be right, Johnny, on the spot with our departure times in order to get off before the tide came in. And that titanium on the airplane does not like salt water at all. Oh. So it's not a good combination.
Yeah, speaking of surfing, the tide changes if you're brave enough and the water's warm enough and the sun is hot enough, you can go down and you can surf the waves into Robb's Inlet.
Oh, really?
In the summer. Yeah, as the tide changes, particularly on low tide days in June, early July, when you get the sort of the corresponding king tides to the winter king tides. There's quite a wave that comes into
Robb's Lagoon.
Robb's Lagoon. Oh. And you'd be amazed. I mean, there's quite a few surfers and kayakers and inner tube riders who take advantage of that. So right here on Vashon.
Oh, be darn.
Nice.
I happened to be out there rowing a couple weeks ago during a tide change right there at the head of Robb's Lagoon, right there where it interfaces with the harbor, and it was the seals who were surfing it. It was really fun to watch. They were definitely playing right there. A lot of fun. Maybe for those of you who don't know, Robb's Lagoon, we give you a quick little lesson of it's an area not well known to many people on Vashon. Even old timers may be unaware that we have. Is it a natural preserve? Does anyone know? Is it a park or under land trust? No. I don't know, but I do know there's picnic table and can go and see Robb's Lagoon, which is on Maury Island, not too far past Tramp Harbor on the inland side towards the Quartermaster Harbor. So it's a nice little walk, wonderful place for birders.
Yeah, it's actually a King County park now. The King County and the land trust took possession, a number of landholders right at the entrance, because those lots are not buildable, decided to sell them at a very low price to King County and the Land Trust. And so it's now a King County Park. So that whole, if you go to the very end of Kingsbury Road on Maury Island, the first sort of road to the right as you come onto Maury Island, it'll take you right down to it. And they've cleaned it up. They've put in some picnic tables. It's a really delightful little area. But Robb's Lagoon it's always been a natural wetland in there. Originally, it was a site of a sawmill. In the 1960s and 70s, they attempted to use it as a salmon hatchery. The state put salmon fry in there, hoping that they would reproduce and move out and then come back and establish the salmon run. Didn't work out, but the concept was there.
All right, what could be better? Vash for Vashonites, King Tides, Rod Lagoon, bring your galoshes, bring your wetsuit, bring your surfboard, bring your kayak and go check it out. So, awesome. Yeah, before we launch into things, I just want to say it's National Scrapple Day today.
Big difference between Scrapple and Scrapple.
Yeah, not the word game. It's the Scrapple. So some people here, I understand, know well about Scrapple.
Ain't gourmet types, really, or chefly men. Now, they're God-fearing folk in that Keystone State, but their food ain't fit for a collection plate. There's things for all kinds of people to hate, but there's one that everybody loves, and they call it Scrapple! Scrapple! Cornmeal steamed and hot-baked apples, set by the window till it's cold and hard, sliced up thick and fried in lard. Hey, what's that swimming in the big red pan that's kicking up all this mania? It's Scrapple! Scrapple! The pride of Pennsylvania!
Yeah. Okay, there you go, boys.
Courtesy of Robbie Folks.
There you go.
So what is the difference between Scrapple and sausage?
Most cultures, including German culture and Pennsylvania Dutch, which are German descendants, have a process where at the end of making sausage and processing meat and all that stuff, you have all these leftovers. And so it becomes, after you boil everything off the bones and you gather all the scraps, you just throw it into a pot. And some areas call it head cheese, but basically it's just it's not, sausage tends to be ground meat
right,
with some additives in it to spice it up and whatever. Scrapple and head cheese are just sort of the... it's all the leftovers you put into.
basically, you sweep the floor after you make sausage, and you got Scrapple. Oh, AKA, is it not Spam, but without the can?
I don't know. Growing up in the South,
Spam is a level up.
That's right. That's for sure.
I don't know. Growing up in the South, I always heard about it, and sausage is a big thing down there, and so is Scrapple. But I avoided anything called head cheese because, frankly, I didn't want to know what was in that.
Yeah, it's kind of like haggis,
No.
Same kind of thing.
Actually, fried up with eggs and grits, it's good.
Yeah, I hate to admit it, but I grew up on Spam. My father, we'd go out to the ranch, and if we were going to have lunch, it'd either be hot dogs or Spam. You know, man, I've eaten my weight in fried Spam, I can tell you. And it's not that bad, really. You know.
Oh, listen, I was a camp counselor in a Girl Scout camp in North Georgia, and we ran out of our food budget by the seventh week of a seven-week stay there, 3 2-week sessions plus our training. Right. And we had Spam every meal for a week.
Oh, boy.
One way or the other. I have not been able to look at it since, nor Scrapple.
Well, Spam, it was a favorite. I'm an aspiring vegetarian, but I have to say, I'd still put my fork down and right into a slab of Spam if it was offered me, fried up and crispy. I gotta tell the truth here. And for me, my habit really was formed when I worked in Hawaii. It's very common in the islands,
right? With pineapple.
I think it was dropped in as a meat in a can. For the military. Bruce, maybe you can tell us more, but it made a landfall there, and it's never left the islands. It's now really part of the culture there.
Yeah, and all through the South Pacific, New Zealand, all through Polynesia, canned hams, Spam type products made here in the U.S. or made in New Zealand or Australia, very, very popular. And for those of you who have the opportunity to drive through southern Minnesota, if you drive through a little town called Austin, Minnesota, there is the National Spam Museum. And it is a kick.
Yeah, is it shaped like the famous can?
It's worth a visit.
I don't think Bruce heard your question.
Bruce, I'm sorry I interrupted you. I was asking if the museum was shaped like the famous Spam can. You know, this kind of ovoid thing.
Yeah, not the building itself. But when you walk in, you cannot escape the Spam can. They're everywhere.
And all right. Well,
they even have a gift shop, so you can buy Spam.
I'm pretty sure Thriftway carries it. Probably.
But not from the original source, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, right.
You know, I always heard that the island, Pacific Islanders were fans of Spam, but it really struck me when I last visited and there was Spam-flavored macadamia nuts.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's just wrong.
So, you know, it's not just for breakfast anymore. and I did bring some home for a buddy of mine, a former Navy enrollee, and he had plenty of Spam in his life, but he ate some of the Spam flavored macadamia nuts, but I don't know that it was a favorite. I should also mention that in addition to British Pudding Day, which somehow doesn't seem coincidental that it shares the Scrapple Day, we also have World Freedom Day, which commemorates the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the end of communist rule in Central and Eastern Europe. So it's actually a big day today for history. Hey, Lynn, you enticed us progressives with an email to Congresswoman Jayapal regarding the False Statements Act. What are you lobbying for with the False Statements Act?
Well, I ran across a reference in Gore Vidal's commentary and book on called Imperial America, and it was written in 2004 about the Bush era and the expansionism that he felt the U.S. had gone into since really 1898. And, you know, now we were in Afghanistan and Iraq and all of that. And he made reference to wondering why Bush had not been charged under the federal false statement statute, which I hadn't heard of specifically. And so I actually wrote Representative Jayapal to kind of find out, you know, are they using that statement? And I started looking it up and going down various rabbit holes that I hope we can discuss. Let me give you a couple of minute kind of outline of where I am with it. The statute itself is part of the U.S. Code, officially titled Title 19, Section 1001, and it's under Chapter 47, which is the Criminal the Crimes and Criminal Procedures Act, and it's Chapter 47, Fraud and False Statements. And it basically says that it's a felony to make false statements to any government official, including law enforcement, members of Congress, or in official proceedings or investigations. And I wondered why Trump had not been indicted or charged under any of those statutes, because especially of the stop the steal of the election and all of that completely unproven statements he's been making about the last election. I learned some very interesting things. One was that George Papadopoulos was indeed charged under that act and threatened with that act to cooperate in Mueller's investigation. And he pled guilty to a lesser charge, allowing him to avoid prison. So apparently this statute, which is punishable by a prison term up to 5 years and or a fine or both, apparently the key here is that you have to be making statements directly to a government official or the Congress or investigations, and that Trump has refused to testify in front of you know, any of those investigations directly, and he has not made false statements about the election to Congress. You know, he's done it all to the public. And apparently it's legal to lie to the public, caveat emptor, you know, be buyer beware. We have to really vet ourselves, you know, what candidates are saying to us. But this law can't apply to him until and unless he makes these statements that are false, clearly false, knowingly and willingly false, directly to the members of Congress or the judicial branch or even to within the elector, within the executive branch. I learned that there's some other interesting things, you know, happening about how then he is being charged in some of these other investigations. It looks like the New York attorney who is investigating Trump's taxes and, you know, financial matters is investigating under fraud statutes, not false statements. And it looks like some of these new people who are being charged, you know, in these last couple of days, well, they're being brought up on, you know, investigations and charges. Apparently, there's been violations of the Hatch Act by 13 members of his administration. And the Hatch Act is you can't both campaign and govern at the same time. It's illegal for federal employees to say, oh, you know, if they're testifying, say Pompeo is one of these people being charged or brought up on this. If he's making a trip to India or something to do something, you know, government oriented, you can't then say, well, re-elect Trump and, you know, this will all get better. That's mm-hmm. kind of an example of that. Most recently, the last thing I'll just kind of mention is that there is a movement afoot right now of the Georgia Attorney General considering to bring up a grand jury to challenge Trump's interference in the overturn of the Georgia election, where, you know, there are audio tapes and all of that of Trump's threatening Brad Raffensperger. But they are bringing him up on RICO charges, which is a federal racketeering charge. So it's just a very interesting ball of wax to me that there's so much protection of anybody, even in high office, to make blatantly false statements. But then, you know, they're being very careful, or he has been very careful, to avoid the exact, you know, bite of the jaws of the law by refusing to testify formally, which would have put him under that clause. So I'm just wondering, you know, what you all think about that whole idea of all these different charges that, you know, we're trying to, I think, make Trump accountable for really destructive statements while he's been in office. So what do you think?
Yeah, I'll start out by saying that there was a brief mention of Rudy Giuliani testifying under oath the other day, and they challenged him on some false statements that he had made. And I think his defense was that he just ran out of time to fact-check. Yeah, to look at us.
Whoopsie.
Just, you know, time is such a precious commodity for Rudy now.
Gosh. Yeah.
Well, I mean, all of this runs right again. I mean, it's a conflict built into our Constitution with the Bill of Rights and the freedom of speech, article. It's a problem. I mean, there's very few legal constraints against lying, unless you damage somebody in that lie. And, you know, for Americans, the concept of a free market of ideas has always been an important part of our justification of the First Amendment rights to free speech. And so it's really a built-in contradiction that how do you find ways to have sanctions against people who lie,
right,
without infringing on people's freedom of speech? It's a difficult line to to walk. And one of the problems is the law is can only be enforced in the way that they're written. And laws are often not written to deal with ambiguities.
Right.
Yeah, I would just add to that, that I think that it is, you know, I think it is a really important thing for us to look at, because it eats away at our very democracy if people can do and say anything with no constraints with regard to the truth. And I think that we do have precedents for holding the line of accountability around truth telling in things like consumer protection laws and libel laws. So we do have a background that does support that legally. Mm-hmm. And I think that we may have to do what you're saying, Bruce, and be more specific around what that, you know, how that plays out when we're talking about, but in particular, politicians lying to the public.
Right. And there's another, I think, implication I didn't really mention, which is this False Statements Act is a felony. So it's a serious crime, which would have to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. So it's the highest standards of proof that he knowingly and willingly, or that anyone knowing and willingly made these statements. And that given the population, half of our population voted for and supports Trump, and that he has such a hold in the Supreme Court and within the Senate, that it could be extremely hard to get enough people to say, yes, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. And so I think we're still having a lot of debate, I guess I'll say, dialogue within our country about what has been happening, what is true, what is not true, does truth even matter? I mean, we've gone down this very kind of scary but important road of trying to figure out how we're going to talk with each other about misinformation, disinformation, and how you convince people.
Well, you know, one of the things that just absolutely drives me insane is you look at Lindsey Graham, for crying out loud, when he was talking about Donald Trump back in the beginning, when, you know, before Trump ran, and he was just trashing Trump up one side and down the other about what, you know, what a character he was. And then he gets elected and, oh no, he's not any of those things. It's like,
exactly.
We've got you on tape, man. I mean, you know, how in the world can they do that? I mean, it just, it boggles the mind.
Let's not be naive about this. When you go back and you look at the Jefferson Adams, the newspaper flyers and blood sheets that came out, and the Andrew Jackson and Lincoln, and even Theodore Roosevelt, and FDR. Anytime there's a time of turmoil, the political rhetoric is just abysmal. But because it's political rhetoric, it becomes acceptable. I mean, the kinds of things
exactly.
They called Thomas Jefferson, and they called Aaron Burr, and they called Andrew Jackson. I mean, they literally wouldn't be printable in a newspaper today. The big difference is that the sort of speed of communications, the internet, the World Wide Web, I mean, the kinds of ways that information gets out, it's a much different environment than it was even in Franklin D. Roosevelt's time, when you read some of the Roosevelt opponents, and the slander against him. But because it's political speech, it's not slander.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'll just kind of end this sort of section, if you want to, by saying that anybody that really wants to look further into this law itself can go to uscode.house.gov, and then if you print in Title 18, Section 1001, you can find the full language of the law, although it's pretty complex to read because it certainly gets into a lot of other aspects of jurisdiction and jurisdictional proof. And so it refers to a lot of other statutes that somebody would really need to be an attorney, you know, to dig through and figure out what's really relevant in what particular situations.
Yeah,
and I just would add to that, you know, these two problems are really coupled together. the problem of dishonest speech, as well as laws that are so complicated that it actually takes an attorney. And even then, it's arguable that, you know, that they understand the laws, or, you know, we have such an overburdened system now of understanding the laws that govern our country. I think in some ways we need to reconsider that issue as well, because until laws are written in ways that the average person can understand them, I don't think that they are actually probably can be fair or upheld, either one.
Interesting, Gail. There's an ongoing debate right now with the in Washington State's Clean Energy Transformation Act, where utilities are required to use carbon-free electricity to serve their customers by 2045. And it turns out the definition of the word "use" has now come under great scrutiny.
Oh, God.
I mean, it's been months and months of hearings and discussions between industry, you know, power company industry folks and environmentalists about how, what does use really mean, and how clean does the electricity really have to be. And I heard a feedback of a conversation with one of the legislators who crafted that language and pushed for it. And the legislator said, use means use, get over it. So even when the laws are not written in a way that requires an attorney to understand them, attorneys can even make plain language apparently be challenging.
which brings into question a third point, is that should we have a system that requires anyone to interpret the law for us? Shouldn't language be simple enough that the average person can understand the law, represent themselves if needed? And that perhaps, I know this is not going to make me popular with a certain group of people, but maybe it's time we reconsider the whole system. And the use
that.
Of representatives, just in the same way, I think it's the same problem I have with the tax code. When you have a tax code that's so complex that you have to pay someone to interpret it every year for you, that is too complex of a tax code. And that's what allows, you know, in my opinion, some people to get off without paying taxes, some people to get off without paying truth, some people to get off without following the law. It's because this shield of complexity that is unnecessary.
I think one of the problems with law is that the language is so, there's so much ambiguity in the language that it has to be written in such a way that it takes away the ambiguity. I mean, as much as it can. And I think that's why you have the complexity that you have. You just like that business about use. What does use mean? You know, well, that's an important distinction. And I mean, Bruce can certainly, I'm sure, illuminate us on that. But yeah, Gail, go ahead.
Well, I think that what I might say is that common sense needs to prevail, and that in some situations like this, so that use is the common understanding of most people, and that's where I think it is made unnecessary. Laws are made unnecessarily complex by lawyers and for lawyers, so that they can continue to perhaps be employed, and so they can hold power. And I think that that's, you know, Lynn.
Well, I'm just going to say I sort of understand and feel what you're talking about, but I don't see it as in any way realistic, because when you train people, for example, in journalism, there is an argument within any kind of journalism about what level you write to. Who is the average man, for example? And so you are expected to write between a fifth grade and an 11th grade education. So that's what the average, quote, man or woman or whatever is seen to be as, and I'm not sure that language is adequate for the complexity of criminal law in particular.
If you write it to the level of Marjorie Taylor Greene, you're out of luck.
Yeah, we have to write some laws that two-year-olds exactly. can follow.
There is precedence, longstanding, in the Roman Empire, as they expanded, one of the things they had was called the 12 tables. And they were the basic laws of the Roman Empire were, as they expanded, were brought into new areas, and they were set in the town centers. And this was a requirement so that people understood what the laws were. And I appreciate that the system that we've built is so complex that, and I can see and I can follow it back historically, but what I'm challenging is that very basis, because we have built a tower now that we stand and look up at and have no idea how to scale something as simple as the president plain out lying about an election, and we're sitting here about who won, and we're discussing that. That's a problem.
Yeah.
Yes.
I feel you.
Well, I will say one, just to sort of maybe wrap up this topic, regarding the political rhetoric and the allowance of falsehoods. It turns out that in our own King County Council race, one of the races involved a racist and unfactual political ad. And it turned out that the council took such exception to the ad that they removed the incumbent's authority on the council, Kathy Lambert by name. And in terms of the good news ways out, challenger Sarah Perry is the newest King County council person. And she was the one whose this racist ad was directed at. So sometimes the good wins out. But while we're on the topic of racist tropes, I do want to make sure we have a little time to talk about a racism incident on Vashon, where apparently in the village green, I believe it was the day of Thanksgiving or the evening before, Halloween, thanks, not Thanksgiving, in the village green, a racist words were spray painted on some of the tables. And of course, in the past, we've had Black leaders, the murals of different Black leaders also defaced. People here may know more details of the incident, but I wanted to start by asking Bruce that we know that America has a long history of threatening those who are different than the majority. And is this action a reflection of that history? Any perspective on what we might, sort of what's behind the motive here in your mind, Bruce, based on history?
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to go, for me, you have to go back to why America was even settled. And it was settled by dissenters. You know, in the Northeast, it was religious dissenters, you know, Quakers and Pilgrims and Congregationalists who were being pushed out of England. Middle colonies were Cavaliers who lost the English Civil War. And you know, the Southern plantations culture sort of came out of the Orange Revolution in England. So all of East Coast America was settled by people who were escaping, you know, being the minority. And so what they did is they inculcated in American culture this idea of, you know, protecting minorities in the sense of protecting free speech and those kinds of things. And as we moved into the Trans-Appalachian West and then further west, those things sort of carried with them. And so there's this sort of tension in American society between protecting minorities, protecting free speech, protecting, you know, religious freedom, those kinds of things. I mean, all protecting my, you know, choice to wear a mask or not, all of those things that are sort of at the base of much of our culture wars today trace back to that. And yet at the same time, those new majorities who founded these news become suppressors of the people that they escaped from who are oppressing them. And so it's a complex, you know, interrelated kind of structure that we're working with. But yes, Americans have always oppressed the other, just as they were oppressed as the other before they came here. So it's a complex kind of relationship in my mind.
So is part of this process of the fact that we're becoming more diverse and less homogenous? I mean, is that people feeling threatened by that and therefore acting out more? Do you think that's a...
Yeah, of course, but it's not the first time.
No, yeah, you know, I agree.
I mean, when you look at the Jacksonian Revolution of the 1820s and 1830s, I mean, it was centered around new waves of immigration from Europe, Irish, quote unquote, slavery, in the post-Civil War period. Those conflicts shifted into Southern and Central Europe, the Italians and the Greeks and the Poles and all those other sort of groups coming in the early part of the late part of the 19th, early part of the 20th century. And I mean, just as there were signs of segregation in the South, different water fountains, different bathrooms. I mean, in the 1820s and 30s, there were separate bathrooms for the Irish.
Yeah, no Irish need apply. 90s,
that's right.
Separate bathrooms for the Italians and the Greeks. I mean, it's deeply embedded within our culture.
And
I did want to ask you a question as a social worker. Yeah. Some people have suggested that the person who did this just wants attention and that we shouldn't really be discussing it like we are discussing it right now. Where, in your opinion, where's the line between ignoring bad behavior as a strategy to subdue it versus standing up against acts that are inconsistent with community mores?
That's a good question, but I think that some of the response to it, for me anyway, is that you can't really conflate an individual act and motivation. I mean, we don't know who that person is and what was harming that person or that what that person was reacting against in particular. We don't know. And you can't confuse that part with the macro level, the higher community societal level of response to a symbolic act. Somebody is sending us signals about racial anger or racial frustration or whatever that meant, or just general vandalism against whatever looked new and, disturbing. That's sort of an individual statement. And does it give it power for us to discuss it? Not in my opinion. I think we need a community conversation about, is violence an answer to a time when here we are all in turmoil? There's so many challenges and stresses on everyone right now. And I think it's obvious that people who have mental illness or people who have substance abuse or high levels of stress in their life often act out. And it is our job to understand why those things happen and deal with it both on the individual level, whether it's a criminal prosecution or a remission to substance abuse or mental health treatment, and to think, how are we as a community going to respond to racial acts or to violent acts within our community? And we have these ads that are going to be going out condemning that kind of violence and, trying to support the businesses and people we have here who are trying to show their own symbolic support sometimes for the, movements that are happening here calling for racial justice. So, it's complex, but they can't be confused, I think. Mm-hmm. Anybody?
All right. Any other thoughts, Gail or Drew?
Just one last thought is, we let Trump skate by with his, behavior.
That's exactly
right. Paying the price for that.
That's exactly right.
You got to stand. You got to stand up to bullies.
I couldn't agree more. It's emboldened that segment of society to act badly, and I think it's important to push back on that.
Yes.
And hate speech isn't something I think we should tolerate ever.
Yeah. So let me just close with
Let me throw something out here real quick, and that is, we got an extra 5 minutes, folks.
remember?
We're going to add another 5 minutes because the. Real Talk is going to come on right behind us, and it was because of the technical issues that we're having, we're going to be live throughout. So when I give you the high sign at 50, you guys are gone, and the new person for Real Talk comes on. So anyway, just thought I'd let you know that. So go ahead.
Okay, we will persevere. Any other comments about this incident on Vashon? Okay, we'll close. Lynn, you referenced. I would tell our listeners to, you know, check out The Beachcomber this week. There's certainly going to be more on this topic in The Beachcomber. And there is a discussion about whether it will also be brought up at the Vashon Mori Island Community Council meeting. I'm sorry, is that right? Yeah, Community Council meeting on Monday, the 15th at 7 p.m. So it's not currently on the agenda, but there are open discussion periods. And we also have a report, I believe, from law enforcement, in which case questions might be asked, and there may be some pertinent questions around this topic as well. So at any rate, Lynn, yes.
Can I ask a question that was given to me by our friend and colleague, Susan McCabe, who is awaiting her show and is here and caught the last few minutes of our conversation about the False Statements Act. And she passed on a question I think she wanted us to discuss on how is it that people can avoid congressional subpoenas. We have people from the previous administration refusing to honor subpoenas to go and testify in these cases. And I haven't had a chance to really think about that yet, so I thought I'd throw it out to the group and see if anybody else has any thoughts or knowledge about that.
They can't.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's pretty straightforward.
They can ignore it, and then they cannot show up. But then it's up to whichever House of Congress issued the subpoena to decide on the punishment. And the punishments can be severe.
But actually, it's referred to the DOJ.
The Department of Justice.
Yeah, the DOJ is the one who makes that determination, not the
House. Okay, sorry. But yeah, but there are criminal penalties for not showing up and not testifying under oath at a congressional subpoena.
It relates to, you know, that the IRS, our national income tax, is voluntary, right? I mean, we voluntarily pay the taxes. And yet, there are penalties if you don't, but it is considered a voluntary tax, which I find very interesting. But if you read the statute, it is voluntary. So there we go.
Most volunteer positions like our jobs here, you know, have severe underlying consequences if you don't do it right.
Anyway, I found that interesting. So.
Well, right. I did Thanks, see, speaking of the DOJ just recently, that I think it's been now going on 2 weeks since the referral from Congress for criminal prosecution of Steve Bannon for having not responded to the subpoena. And of course, there's another round of six that have now been identified, of which it looks like at least five, according to news reports, are likely to follow in Bannon's footsteps. And so one of the attorneys that I saw last night, probably many of our listeners did, said, you know, I'm not too worried right now because, you know, Garland and the DOJ, they do have a process. We should allow that process to happen. But it's not like, you know, this requires a study. This is like, if we don't hear something by next week, we should be really concerned about what's going on within the Department of Justice on this issue. So we shall see.
Again. Exactly.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And I think it rounds back to what Bruce brought up earlier. It's when you let this kind of thing go and this bad behavior stand like we did during number 45's administration, and number 45 himself getting away with so many egregious acts, you then embolden others to do that. And I think that is a very large problem where it becomes the norm or an acceptable choice to disregard subpoenas.
To me, Lynn. Quickly, what's difficult is that we experience and suffer these depredations in real time, but it takes the law, its processes, a little bit of time to catch up and formulate what the case is and put it before the proper jurisdiction. So we live in that interstices, you know, in that place between what's happening and what the consequences are going to be. We just have to learn how to suffer that.
Yes, and unfortunately, you know, it's newsworthy and grabbing when they, you know, when they refuse to show for a subpoena. And I think that many of the constituents that might support that kind of behavior all get riled up over that, and they get a little charge out of it. And so it's, I think it's very important that as big a deal or bigger deal needs to be made of the consequences of that, of those choices.
Okay, guys, we are out of time, and it's now time for a real talk with our good friend Susan McCabe. So we're going to go directly to that, and we will see you guys next week.
Thanks. I'll be hosting next week.
Here we go.
Bye-bye.